welcome to the latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast, hosted by data protection people. My name is Ollie Rear, and I'm joined for the purposes of this intro by Carrie. Hello, Carrie.
Hello, Ollie.
How are you this not-so-fine afternoon?
Oh, it's lovely where I am. I say lovely, it stopped raining for a bit. I'm good.
Oh, lucky you.
Getting stuck in about SARS.
Yeah, lucky you. It's absolutely miserable here, but nonetheless, it was a really good session today.
Yeah, it was really interesting. I thought some of the discussion that came up, especially like around CCTV, was really interesting to get stuck into. And we had some really good sort of queries thrown out by the audience as well.
Yeah, this is really the type of session where we've earned our living on this one, really. I mean, it's sometimes the sessions can just be sort of all jolly and all friendly, and occasionally we do get things thrown at us, and this was one where we had to we were kept on our toes a little bit, weren't we?
Yeah, I actually really enjoyed that. I thought some of the questions that came through were really interesting ones, especially with how the ICO had responded to somebody on a query. I won't spoil that for now. But that was very interesting, their sort of take on something.
Look at you setting up teasers now. You were already doing segues in the session. You're a natural at this. But yeah, no, I agree with you. So that's one of the benefits of this, actually, is the community and how they've potentially had interactions which we've not had the chance to experience ourselves. So that's always really good. So yeah, fantastic session. As Carrie says, it's about SARS. It's part three in our subject access request trilogy at this point. Today we spoke primarily about exemptions, didn't we, Carrie? We spoke a lot about the serious harm test, about third party information. And as you say, there was plenty of interesting things that came out of that. So it's a really good session. We do really hope you enjoy it. Before we let you get stuck in, there are a couple bits from us just to remind you of. These events are run live every Friday lunchtime, so you can come along if it's of interest. Please do feel free to do so. You can get involved by contacting any of us on the socials or the info@DPP email address. The list of events, because we run themed events and open surgery sessions, will be on the DPP website on Monday, which will be the 21st, I think. Yes, the 21st. Brand new list of events out there for everyone to get involved with. In particular, we're hosting a session for the hospice sector that has been orchestrated by our very own Temi. So we're looking forward to that. Should be really interesting. And while you're on the website, you can also check out details of the DPP DPO bootcamp. We're running some training sessions for new and aspiring, but also seasoned pros who want to jog their memory a little bit. It should be really fab. We've worked really hard on this program. It's being run remotely in March and also physically in person in June. So if that's of interest, either head to the website or just reach out directly to any of us. And finally, if you enjoy this podcast, please do leave us a rating. It really helps. Wherever you get your podcasts, drop us a good rating, and it helps get the name out there. It helps us build our little community, and our community, which was on fire, Carrie, today, wasn't it?
Yes, it was a really good discussion today.
And without further ado, we will let you get into that discussion. So I will leave you in the very capable hands of Carrie James and myself. In the news. Now, I know that you've been very busy this week, so you may not have had a chance to keep an eye on the news, but is there anything at all you wanted to raise? I mean, I've got a couple bits here, if not.
Yeah, I was looking through your list. It's quite interesting reading them. There's only one of those that I've definitely sort of noticed in the news, and it was the two blokes that were jailed for stealing loads of credentials and then selling it for cryptocurrency.
Yes, yes.
That's sort of the one that I've seen in, like, passing.
Yeah, so it made headlines. I mean, there's not too much to say on this, but I thought it was probably worth mentioning. I mean, in all honesty, most of the news stories I get now are sent in to me, either by Mark or Joe likes to fire bits in, and this is one that Joe fired into me.
Got there first with it, then.
Yeah, basically, that's the top tip. Basically, it's two chaps from I want to say Rochdale, but that might be wrong.
I think one of them was from Liverpool.
Okay.
They were at Liverpool Crown Court.
Right, okay. And basically, one of them has been jailed, I think, for a short period. One of them's copped community service and a suspended sentence, I think. But basically, what they've been doing is that they sent out a bunch of emails masquerading as Spotify, iTunes, various sort of tech giants that people would be subscribed to, and nicked a load of credit card details and Apple Apple IDs, basically login credentials for accounts and card data.
Yeah.
And I thought what was interesting about this, so one of the things, I mean, you mentioned that they then tried to sell it all off for cryptocurrency, which there's not really too much to say about that. We've mentioned crypto before on here, but I'm very reluctant to make it a recurring feature, so less said about that the better. But I thought it was interesting they nicked. So they reckon they nicked about 90,000 credentials, right? 90,000 instances of logins and card details, etc. And then they were able to flip that reportedly on the dark web for about 140 grand. Now, I don't claim to know what the going rate is for stolen credentials, but it doesn't really seem like a lot. I mean, 140 grand for 90,000 instances of card details doesn't feel like that's particularly good return on investment from their perspective, especially if you're going to cop a prison sentence for it. But I don't know. I don't know what the going rate is, but I just thought that was of note. I can't imagine there's anything more to say on that, really. Is the carriage?
I think it's just sort of reminding that, you know, these emails can sometimes look very convincing. Yes. I've certainly had a couple of them, and there had been the odd one where I thought, oh, does that actually look accurate or not? And I've had to scroll down to look at like the footer of the email, where that's when it tends to all go a bit weird. So they're obviously like, they've managed to convince like 90,000 people to put in this information. So they must be getting like more convincing with how they're looking.
Yeah. Well, we've spoken about scams a number of times, and you know, while it's very easy to maybe be a bit condescending to people who fall for these scams, they are getting increasingly sophisticated. That's not to say that all are, but you definitely see some now which are
You could tell, like,
quite incredible.
They've made sure that the language, like the English in them, is more correct than it used to be, because that used to be the easiest way to spot one that was scammy.
Yes.
Was it broken English on it, whereas now they've, a lot of them I sort of get in my junk mail seem to have sorted that issue out. So now it's sort of trying to look at the actual email address it's coming from to check if it looks like a genuine Netflix or a genuine PayPal one.
Yeah, no, 100%.
Smarter, isn't it?
Yeah. Other bits I saw this week. One is, without wanting to get too gossip column-y about it, but I'm sure some people at least will remember the spat between the two spouses of England footballers, Wayne Rooney and Jamie Vardy. The spat dubbed rather creatively, or not as the case may be, Wagatha Christie. But it was all to do with, honestly, I'm not going to go over it because it's not really that interesting, but it's all to do with one of them leaked allegations about her husband and they got into some spat. Anyway, I really don't want to get into the details of it because it's certainly not the tone of this space. But what I did think was interesting is that this week, one of them tried to bring a misuse of private information claim against the other. Now, MOPI, for short, misuse of private information, something we've spoken about previously. So that is a tortious action, right, which fundamentally comes out of, technically it comes out of the Campbell case, Naomi Campbell. But I think it's interesting because we've seen it increasingly applied, or be attempted to be applied anyway, in data breach claims. So I know we've mentioned it a couple of times before. I think, Carrie, you've probably seen examples of it, some of these claim letters that come through when organizations have had a breach and people are trying to take them to court over it, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things that sometimes they try and claim is misuse of private information, because it's all, because it is a recognized tortious action. But since I believe it's Warren and DSG Retail Limited, which is very interesting, came out a couple of months back, that the scope of that's been severely limited. And so I thought it was interesting to see the application of MOPI in a more appropriate, I suppose, context, because that's what it was originally designed for. It was kind of an action for celebs to, you know, sue paps really, and the newspapers. Although in this case, just to be clear, it was not successful, and the party who failed to bring it was ordered to pay, I think, about £70,000 to cover legal costs. So that's the amount it cost them for the privilege of trying to bring it. But yeah, I just thought that was interesting to see how it can apply differently and perhaps more directly.
That is interesting, that one.
Yeah. Last one is, and then we get stuck in. I mean, there's not too much this week because I've also been relatively busy. But one thing I did see and I thought was worth mentioning, particularly, you know, the last few weeks we've spoken at length about all of the action which has come about because of Max Schrems's outfit bringing all of those complaints in to the Austrian Data Protection Authority and in front of the Austrian courts. And obviously we've had the Google Analytics judgment, right? We've had the Google fonts the other week. So I just thought this was worth raising, which is that, so we've spoken previously about Google's privacy sandbox and the fact that they are looking to basically do away with cookies, right, as a mechanism, and replace them with this alternative technology. And they've announced this week that they're going to be rolling that out not just to Google Chrome, but also to all Android phones. So all Android phones are going to have this tech in place, which limits tracking technologies, basically, which is an expansion on the cookie work they're doing, just to be clear. And I mean, we've spoken before about whether this is inherently a good thing or a bad thing. Does it matter whether, you know, the intention behind it is purely commercial or out of a genuine interest of you know, promoting privacy? Does that even matter? I'm not entirely sure. But one of the things that came out of this announcement is Meta, so Facebook's parent company now, announced in the wake of that, or sort of retorted, that they think that the equivalent measures deployed by Apple, so I'm sure anyone who's got an iPhone knows that in the latest update, Apple have pushed this technology, which requires, well, which enforces consents for cross-app tracking. So you get those little screens that pop up saying, ask app not to track, etc. Anyway, Facebook reckons that's going to cost them $10 billion over the course of this year, which is both extraordinary and somehow not surprising, because we all know that if this product's free, then really, you know, you're paying with your data, right? But some big numbers involved.
Yeah, I mean, how much of that is like going to be actually hurt Meta as a financial loss, or is it actually not so much, even though it's like a really big number, it might not be so much of a loss for them because they just make so much money anyway off the data that people are inputting in their apps generally.
Yeah, is it lost revenue, or is it a projection? Is it loss of trust from investors? It could be anything, right? I mean, that figure could be anything, but I just thought it was interesting. Again, it's one of the developments, but not too much more to say about that. And so on that note, I suggest that we get into topics which you and I certainly know a whole lot more about, because we've been speaking about it since the start of the year, but that's how much we enjoy it, which is subject access requests. And yep. So off the back of, so we've done, this is the third session, as I mentioned, for anyone who's not aware of that. And the two previous sessions we'd done, though, I mean, they were relatively informal, but we ended up on the last one talking quite heavily about exemptions, and people said that they might fancy an exemption focused session. So that's what we're doing today, ultimately. So I thought it was probably worth, Carrie, going back a little bit, because we can be sometimes, you know, a bit aggressive and jump straight into the Data Protection Act, etc. But I thought it was worth dialing back a second and looking at, where do these exemptions come in within the broader statutory framework? So we're talking, aren't we, about rights, ultimately, so the rights under the GDPR. Yeah. But those are, well, none of them really are absolute. And they are further qualified under Article 12 in part, but then the right of access specifically is also qualified under 15.4, I think, is it? And basically, the European statute initially said that, you know, national bodies will be able to amend the law to make it fit. And within that, they can create exemptions. That's broadly what we're talking about, isn't it? Sorry, yeah. That was a slightly odd explanation. I'll be honest, I got caught off guard by what Andrea means by asking people to check their cameras, because I turn off incoming video, if I'm being honest, so I'm not entirely sure what that's about.
Yeah, I know what she's saying. If everybody just wants to check that they're happy with their cameras on or off.
Yeah, okay, no worries.
Sorry, guys, it's Andrea here. I refer, you know, some people are not aware their camera is on, and I just can't help but hoping to prevent something because you're not aware your camera is on.
Yeah.
I would like to say it. It's not nice for anyone. Thank you.
No, nice one. But
I don't have the power to switch her off, unfortunately. Just bear with me a second. I will sort it out.
Okay, no worries. Cheers, Miles. So yeah, Carrie, that's the framework within which we're operating, right? But actually, under the GDPR, there are very few exemptions, right? So there's mm-hmm. manifestly unfounded and excessive, but primarily when we're talking about exemptions, really, we're looking at the Data Protection Act, aren't we? And specifically, yeah. Schedule 2. So do you want to start running us through broadly how that interoperates, and maybe looking at some of the key ones? Because I know that as I have, you've applied a number of these exemptions previously in both this role and others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's like the GDPR sort of sets out some, like you've said, a few bits, but the Data Protection Act then goes one step further and sets out further exemptions that can be applied, so it supplements the GDPR. The main ones that I think people will have come across is redacting third-party information, legal professional privilege, negotiations, maybe as part of legal professional privilege. They tend to have a lot of overlap depending on what your case is about. And serious harm, they're the ones that, when I've worked with the public sector, they're the ones I've used the most.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple of other random little ones that I think you'd only apply them in very specific circumstances. So I haven't had experience in applying those because it's just not really come up.
No, and I think it's probably worth at this point covering off why that's likely to be the case, right? Which is that ultimately these exemptions, first of all, you have to apply them. I mean, you really have to apply them on a case by case basis, right? It's not just this entire request, or very rarely will it be the case that this entire request is somehow exempt for one reason or another. It's that this specific document or this specific piece of information, this specific data set might be exempt by virtue of one of these provisions, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's probably something that's worth acknowledging at the top here. But you're right. So some of them are far more broadly applicable. Some of them are far more narrow. So I thought we might start with, unless anyone feels otherwise, with probably the exemption which is applied the most and is sometimes, in fact, not sometimes, I think often probably, although you feel free to disagree with me on this, probably applied without really knowing about it or understanding it, which is protecting the rights and freedoms of others, isn't it? Yeah. So that's very often applied. And generally we talk about not disclosing third party data, but actually that's what this exemption is. So, I mean, do you want to run us through maybe specifically how it works? Because as I say, I think a lot of the time organizations will say, oh, well, it's third party data, we can't disclose it. But that's not automatically the case.
No,
right?
It's not a blanket thing that you can say, right, any name that appears in this document that isn't the name of the data subject needs to be removed. That's not the case at all. It's removing third party data where there may not be any relation whatsoever to the data subject that's requesting it. So if you had meeting minutes where you discuss various tenants that may have potential issues in a meeting, you would redact all the other people because they have absolutely nothing to do with the requester at hand. In other times, you might redact things where it's a really junior member of staff who has absolutely no involvement, really. Like you might be organising a meeting room for a disciplinary or something, can you sort of like ask a colleague, oh, can you just organize this for me and sort the people out so they're there? They don't actually have any involvement or any influence on anything, so I would redact that person.
Sure.
It's also sort of being considerate of, you know, what does the data subject already reasonably know about somebody? So in the case, so like my, with public sector, I did a lot of sort of childcare, sort of social worker, SARS and things like that. A lot of the information that may have other people's names, you could potentially leave in because they've provided that information themselves or they know about it already. So yes, you'd leave it in. I have seen people take this to extremes where somebody had redacted the name of the data subject's own children. And I was like, I'm pretty sure they reasonably know what their kids are called.
Yeah.
And that, you know, they know their kids were in the house when this meeting happened. So I think you can leave the kids' names in. It's a balancing test. It's sort of a balancing thing of reasonableness of what do they already know? What is the harm in disclosing it to the third party? You know, where there's absolutely no harm at all because the information's already known. It's already out in the open. There's no need to redact it.
Yeah, well, I think that's a very good point because really what the law says is that the right of access will not apply wholly or in part. Again, just to reiterate what we said before, it's not a blanket thing, but it won't apply, or at least the controller won't be forced to disclose that information if it involves disclosing information relating to another individual who is identifiable, right?
Yeah.
That's broadly what it is, which is interesting because actually when we see, because that's very specific and actually relatively narrow, because the name of the exemption is protection of the rights of others, right? But really what it is saying it's not really to do with other people's rights. It's just don't disclose information that identifies them. Whereas actually, if you look at some of the European variants, it is far broader and actually allows for like intellectual property rights to be covered and, you know, rights to business critical information and that sort of stuff. So it's way broader. But that's probably what we have in the UK. And as you quite rightly say, there's a reasonableness element to it, which basically comes under the next subparagraph of it because it's all, you know, structured that way, which basically says that the obligation to disclose data isn't removed if either the individual, the third party whose data it is, has consented to the disclosure, or if it is reasonable to disclose their information without their consent. And then there's a list of relevant criteria to consider, right, in determining what's reasonable. And well, I don't think necessarily it's worth going through them with a fine comb unless anyone on the session wants that. But I think broadly, and without wanting to be too flippant about it, I think it's pretty common sense, right?
Yeah, a lot of it is. I always think it's like, how are these people involved with this person? So where it's sort of saying assumption of reasonableness to leave them in without getting their consent, it's things like social workers, like their names, teachers, their names, if they've had, you know, if they've got documents that they've contributed to. I think names of professionals who are acting in their professional capacity, where they may have made decisions that have affected the data subject, like positive or negative, not like it doesn't have to be one way or the other, but I think there's an assumption of reasonableness there that their names would be disclosed as they've made a decision on something in their professional capacity. I never see a reason to withhold names in that particular circumstance.
Well, that's specifically provided for, isn't it, the next sort of section, which is, as you say, the assumption of reasonableness.
But
which
people
is
do still try to withhold them.
Well, yeah.
But people just apply it as a blanket.
Yeah, well, yeah, we know that. That's its own provision, which is that not only is it reasonable in certain circumstances to disclose, but you can assume by default that it's reasonable where, as you quite rightly say, it relates to, I think it's generally people acting in their official capacity, right? So a GP writing up a report or whatever, then it's deemed to be reasonable because sort of why wouldn't it be, I guess. I think one of the things I wanted to come back on very quickly, and I don't know if you've got any thoughts on this specifically, but one of the aspects which is interesting under this specific exemption is that when it talks about not disclosing information relating to others, that's actually further specified down in the subsections of that particular exemption. And it talks about actually that including information which could allow you to identify the source of information, and also pushes you to consider whether the requester of the subject access request could reasonably identify this person with other information available to them. So actually it broadens it out quite significantly, and that's actually very important a lot of time, particularly in social housing, isn't it? I mean, we apply it all the time.
Could be like in the circumstances where you've got a complaint, the person, like obviously you withhold their name, but there might be details of the complaint which would help the data subject work out which house the complaint had come from. If they're saying, I can see this from my kitchen window, you know, I can see into this room and they're doing this, or I can hear noise through the walls. If you're in a semi-detached house, you're going to know it's probably your neighbours that have complained about noise through the walls. So it's redacting sort of that contextual information as well, which may lead to identification, even if you've not given out an explicit name and address.
Yeah, well, the one I've applied it in, which is the most sort of clear-cut application of this, and I don't know if anyone else has ever come across this, but obviously when you're dealing with housing in particular, you get all sorts with tenants and CCTV systems in particular. And one of the things I've had is the neighbours putting up cameras which record next door, and they submit that as part of ASB. But obviously, if you were the person being recorded, you'd get the stills or the footage and go, well, I can clearly work out which camera that's come from, because you can retrace it and you go, oh, well, that's the neighbour, clearly. So that identifies the source, you know, almost immediately. So I'm always very keen to say, well, don't disclose that, because it identifies the source. But then again, it sort of depends, you know, what, again, just because, and I think this is probably something we want to drive home across all these exemptions, isn't it? And something that you mentioned earlier. So I certainly won't take credit for it, but just because the exemption applies doesn't necessarily mean that you're obliged to withhold something, right? You know, you have to contextualize it. They're exemptions, not obligations.
It's mechanisms of withholding things where the need is there, but you don't have to do it just because it's there. You know, you need to consider each piece of information on its own merit, in its own circumstances, what's already known about the situation, what could be, you know, what needs to be withheld, but also what could be disclosed without causing harm, even if you could withhold it.
Yeah,
you know, just because it's an exemption there doesn't mean you need to use it.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that's particularly relevant, actually, in relation to what some of the chat is saying. So James is saying that they've been advised by the ICO help desk to redact all names regardless, which they always thought was a bit off. So I assume that's in relation to what we were talking about before. So obviously redacting information of third parties. And yeah, I don't think that's proportionate at all. There's no need to redact as a blanket approach. I think that's far too aggressive. And it's surprising to hear that from the ICO. And then Joe is saying, what about emails that are sent between staff and data subject? We had a situation when a resident stated they were going to publish the emails in a publication they are writing. ICO online support told me that if resident published that data and we provided it as part of the SAR, then we have breached DP laws. Got legal advice and they suggested just wipe out all names and emails where the data subject has prior access to it. So basically we've got a situation where someone has requested their data and has stated that they intend to publish it upon receipt. Well, there's a couple things in there. First of all, in terms of emails sent and received by data subjects, whether it's you know, an employee or a customer, and I believe that the latest CNIL guidance backs this up, but I think our approach, Carrie, correct me if I'm wrong, but we've always said just give it to them. There's no need to redact. They've seen it already.
You can either give it to them, or you could, I think there's the option of saying, well, actually, you know, you already reasonably have copies of this yourself. But we'd always just give them anyway, just to show we were holding this. So we'd give them it. We wouldn't redact anything, because in theory, they should have it anyway. So
that's right. And you're just wasting resources at that point.
Yeah, you're just spending time like redacting email addresses and phone numbers and stuff. Could take a long time, depending on how many emails there are.
Yeah, absolutely. But I wanted to pick up actually on this second point, right? So in Joe's question about, so the ICO is suggesting that if they disclose something as part of a SAR and then an individual went around publicising that, that somehow the organisation would have breached DP laws. That seems absurd to me, and I simply don't think that's right.
Yeah, that makes absolutely no sense to me whatsoever.
Because arguably what you would have there is a, if, because the whole point is that the law doesn't apply to individuals because of the quote unquote household exemption, right? So that's Article 3 material scope, I think, or Article 2, maybe I'm getting confused, but the scope of it, basically the law, it's not really an exemption actually, it's just that the law doesn't apply to household activities, and that's why it doesn't apply to us all in our day-to-day lives. However, as soon as you start to use data in a way which is outside of your day-to-day activities, then you're deemed to be a controller, you're caught by the law. So in that sense, to my mind, if you've disclosed data to an individual and then they start publicizing that, surely they enter into controllership, and it's nothing to do with the disclosing controller initially.
Yeah, I don't know how an organisation could be held liable for fulfilling a SAR that then that request has taken that information provided as part of the SAR that the organisation has a legal obligation to comply with, to then do their own thing with it. I kind of thought that you'd maybe need to just get legal advice on how you would then tackle that if, you know, if that arises.
Well,
but I don't know how the organisation could be held liable under data protection.
Yeah, Joe, they're saying that they got legal advice and they suggested that they just wipe out all names in the emails. But then that sort of puts you between a rock and a hard place, because arguably then you're getting into territory of being overzealous with your redactions, which arguably isn't necessarily non-compliant. It's just a bit opaque. But it's a very... I don't think that's right at all. Andrea, sorry, I saw your hand pop up there for a second. I don't know if you want to jump in on this. Please do.
I was just saying the question of why the organization is being held liable. I believe it's, and I think I say it's right, you need to redact all names, because it's your responsibility. You know that you're going into a court case. You know how human behavior is. There are people that are fishing for money and other things. So you know what the risk is there. If you are giving them data with other individuals, and if you give them the data and it's not fully redacted, that's a risk that can be used for a certain purpose. So I agree with ICO. I think, especially when you are dealing on another matter, and then the subject access requests or all these rights, they come as a, you know, additional pain in a company's behind, let's say, because, you know, they have an ulterior motive, these requests in such a situation. Companies, I believe, should be more aware of the risks involved. So there are different elements from different angles that you need to look at in this situation. So I agree with ICO and why the company would be held liable, because you know you have a different case that's going in parallel with this, you know, this request is such a small part of the bigger picture, you know, you should expect, you know, the risks involved. So if you give your data, you as a company give data to someone else that can potentially be used to with other purposes and so on, that yes, I believe that the company should be responsible. So you shouldn't have issued in the first place that type of data. You should have redacted it, my opinion. So I agree with ICO, in my opinion.
I hear what you're saying, but I'm afraid I'm not entirely sure I agree, which is the nature of these things, isn't it? I mean, us practitioners get together, it's always
an
argument.
It's very subjective, you see. I tell people in the company, it's not black and white, it's very gray, and it's down to logic and interpretation many times, which is a global view. It's how you justify your decision, because if the law doesn't do that for you.
Oh, no, 100%, 100%. I think... I mean, the way I'm coming at it is that if we apply the logic to disclosure between two controllers, right, which is ultimately what it would be if the individual started publishing it, because then you end up in a situation of controllership effectively for the individual. Well, as long as you as the disclosing controller have fulfilled all your responsibilities, as long as you're satisfied that you had a lawful reason for doing so, which you would have because you'd have been complying with a legal obligation, all that might be a stretch, but as long as you were satisfied effectively that you're doing things by the book, then arguably I'd have thought that the risk lay, or at least the liability lays, with the party who then subsequently misuses that data. I hear what you're saying in terms of contextualizing. I do agree with you on that point, which is that not necessarily that you should know better, but if you've got the information to hand, then you need to. But again, this kind of comes back to what we're saying, right? It's always a case by case basis, and you have to look at things in context, which I do understand and I do appreciate. Carrie, anything you want to chip in with on this?
Yeah, I agree with you, Ollie. I mean, I know that she was saying about in case of legal cases, but not every SAR has that kind of outcome. So you don't, it's not necessarily something that you need to be concerned about for every SAR that you do. So you don't need to redact with that in mind. Well, but then also that wouldn't really cover third party information.
Yeah. So it's very context specific. I see that Joe, who's the originator of this conundrum, has a hand up. So if you want to come in, Joe, and give us some info and put us out of our misery, then please do.
So yeah, I agree with both of you two, Ollie and Carrie, because I was like gobsmacked when I said that. And I turned it round on them as well. So, you know, when you do the ICO chat, you can get a copy of the chat afterwards.
Yes, I always download that and save it.
So I said to the online advisor, so if I get a copy of this chat and publish it, ICO are now in breach of data protection laws. They said that first, potentially. So I was like, that's just silly. So, yeah, because I agree with you. If the data subject already has it, then why would we be redacting it? Because they could just go into the sent emails and, or, you know, receive emails and get it.
Yeah.
But yes. So we've now in a position where we have to redact everything, and even calls, we have to make sure we take out all names of customer service advisors who give their full name when they answer the phone.
Actually, as another thought, before, like, I'm probably going down a rabbit hole, but if you've given them a copy of the emails that they already have access to, you give them a copy of that email as an email, you know, you don't PDF it or whatever. How are the ICO going to know which version of the email is being disclosed to know whether it's the organization's fault or the data subject's fault? How are they going to know?
Quite.
Because they'll be identical.
Yeah. What this comes down to, right, and again, without, I think we probably need to move on from this because we could spend all afternoon talking about this because it's a great topic, but.
Yeah.
What I think a lot of it comes down to, and actually it's a bit of a shame because I didn't really look into it, but it comes down kind of to vicarious liability, right? Are you responsible for the actions of a third party because you've enabled effectively their access to the information that they're misusing, which is kind of what happened under the Morrison's case, right? And I think has happened.
Yeah.
I think there's been another ruling subsequently, quite recently, if anyone's got that in relation to this. And that's kind of what it comes down to. It's fascinating. It's really interesting. But I'm afraid I think we probably should move on because there's a lot of points in the chat and a couple that I really want to get to. But thank you, Joe, for raising that. And thank you, Andrea, for playing devil's advocate, because the risk is that we all agree with one another and it becomes a bit of an echo chamber. So thank you both for your contributions. There's a point here. So Adele's asking about ASB complaints. So where the data subject knows the complaints were raised about them and asked for the details, but if you provide them to the data subject, it risks aggravating the ASB issue as a result. Super common for housing, right, Carrie? We see this all the time. I assume relatively common for the public, for councils as well, and local authorities, at least to some extent. Broadly, and this might not be what the guidance or the law says, but I'd be inclined to take a... I'd just be inclined to take the safest approach, really, when it comes down to these cases. And if it's between, what we've often said is that we'd much rather get a slap on the wrist from the ICO than risk someone, you know, going around caving someone else's head in because they've read something they don't like. And for us, that's all, well, at least for me anyway, that's always been the approach I've taken, which is that I'd rather take a view that the risk is greater to aggravating antisocial behaviour instances than it is us being, you know, slightly in breach of the law on certain minor points, I think.
I fully agree. I've applied like, it sort of comes into that serious harm exemption as well that we could always segue into a little bit. You know, there's, it has very prescriptive steps to apply, but it's not always the easiest to apply for every organisation. So you sort of have to take a viewpoint of, well, if we withhold and we have this evidence that hasn't come from a health professional or a social care worker, but it has come from, you know, trusted individuals, that this may happen if this information is disclosed, then I'm always happy to try and like chance it, withhold it. And if the ICO say to disclose it, in the face of the evidence that's being gathered to say that actually this person might harm themselves or someone else,
yeah,
then it's like, well, that's the ICO. It's on them. Like, as an organisation, you could say, like, well, we tried to prevent this, but the ICO said to disclose. And
that's
I have had it before in the past with a case, and in the end, we sort of challenged the ICO, and in the end, they just kind of came back with a, well, you do what you want, but just document why you've done it.
Sat on the fence,
which is what I'd expect them to do. So as long as you have enough evidence of your own, you know, if you think there's a very real risk of this person having got the information in black and white, that they're then going to go around and create more antisocial behaviour issues for the person that complained, then yeah, I would try and withhold that.
Yeah, I mean, as Rick's saying, you know, he's echoing what we're saying, saying, you know, always better to sit in front of the ICO and explain your decision making than following the law and potentially causing harm.
Yeah, trying to explain to somebody why they've had this person knocking on the door threatening to brain.
Exactly. I appreciate your attempt to segue, Carrie, and I will pick you up on that in just a second. However, just because there's a few points in the chat I still want to get to, there's one in particular I really like from James, saying that in terms of, so that query, that rabbit hole that we went down a second ago, yes. James suggests you watermark everything, saying it's part of a SAR and has been released to this particular person and is no longer a controlled document of the organisation. I'm not entirely sure how well that would stand up, but I really like the idea. Although, obviously, I think you probably apply on a case-by-case basis, right? Because you might look at it and go, this person's at risk of going and spreading this around, so we might apply it here. But
them a heads up as well. This is what I'm going to do when you give me the stuff, because some people don't give you that lovely heads up of their future plans. So
Funnily enough, I can't say too much about this, but we were kind of involved in an issue that went to the ICO where... So it was for a school we work with, and they maintain a quite substantial archive, possibly too substantial, in fact, but that's a different issue. And they have these sort of part-time volunteer archivists that man it, and one of them decided to help themselves to a load of material out of it and write a book and publish it without telling anyone, which is not exactly the same, but fairly similar, you know, vicarious liability territory. And I don't know why I started telling something like that, because I've forgotten the outcome of it. The ICO were involved, but I can't remember what they said, so I shouldn't have brought it up.
I know what you're talking about, but I don't know the ICO outcome either.
I'll tell you what, it's a nice teaser for next week. I'll go look up in the files what they said, and I'll come back to you all with a response. So just before we move on, so a couple more points in the chat before we do move on, because there's plenty we still need to talk about, and we've only got about 15 minutes to do so, which is incredible. Is there any information you should be telling the data subject along with the SAR response from Emma? Well, technically, you're supposed to give them information under article, basically, what is the information under articles 13 and 14, right? You're basically meant to explain to them how their data is being handled, but really, if your privacy notices are good enough, you can just give them a copy of the privacy notice.
Yeah.
But sometimes, depending on what you do, it might be worth giving them an explainer and saying, look, this is why this is the case, etc. I always think that's beneficial. Christine saying, in that case, are we suggesting that all emails should come from a generic email address? They will have already had the details if the emails have been sent from them or directly from the employee. So that's back to that rabbit hole point. I'm going to stick to my guns, and I think keep applying business process, keep regular course of business. And I would continue to just either release or withhold email sent or received as a bit of a blanket approach, depending on what you think is right in the instance. Because if they've already had it, they've already had it, I think.
Yeah.
I think let's stick with that at the risk of going down another rabbit hole.
Yeah.
And there's a few other points, but while I pick through them and pick out the salient points to put to everyone else, Carrie, could you please act upon that segue that you so cleverly set up a second ago, albeit slightly outdated, and take us through. It was serious harm test, wasn't it, you wanted to talk about?
Yes.
Yeah, let's go.
This is sort of when you think you've found information within the files that you think if you disclose it to the requester, it will basically cause them serious harm to read about it. Sometimes it can be instances of self-harm or where there's been abuse, things like that, where if they read it, it may cause them a lot of upset. It may be that somebody's involved that knows somebody that knows this person at the minute has like sort of their mental health quite fragile, so to read a lot of information about themselves in sort of written down in that kind of context might be really upsetting to them.
Mm-hmm.
It is a process where you do have to sort of qualify it with a few steps. You've got to, you know, identify the information that you think will actually cause real harm, and you need to have an appropriate professional give their opinion on it. So it would be, you know, if there's a social worker involved or a medical professional, sort of maybe a GP, somebody like that, who could pass their professional like opinion of, yes, if this information is disclosed to this person, this, you know, is likely to happen. Obviously, when I worked in the council, this was a lot easier for them to apply because there's social workers there, that you have easy access to a social worker. There's usually one involved in the case. So you could easily ask them their opinion. You get their opinion and be like, right, okay, you know, we've noted that. With housing organisations, it can be harder to access those particular professional individuals.
Sure.
And I think sort of where it comes back to case by case basis, how much evidence can you gather that this might happen? How, you know, how much do you know about the data subject already, you know, to think what, you know, this might actually happen if you give them that information. You know, who's still involved with them that you can ask, even if they're not a health professional or a social worker.
Yeah.
You know, exhaust your avenues where you can. If you think they might be still under social work support in a different area because they've moved, you know, contact that council. You know, we've got a subject access request. Does this person have a social worker involved that may be able to give an opinion on their case? But I always think with this one, it's sort of a little bit more like go with your gut, because you do have the opportunity to review it again at internal review, mm-hmm. and also the ICO. And
yeah.
I'd rather have a slap on the wrist for withholding stuff where you've maybe been slightly overzealous on the risk, because you don't really want to be the cause of somebody harming themselves
by
giving them the information.
Sure. And just to support that, and something which David is saying in the chat, and I completely agree with, and I've also sort of gone through the process myself with some of my customers, is where there's a social worker involved potentially, or at least a, if it's not a social worker, at least a support network potentially, then getting the requester to sit with the social worker and work through the content in a sort of safe environment and with that support, just because I think you're absolutely spot on, which is that, you know, if you're in a certain frame of mind, then just being dumped with, you know, potentially hundreds of pages of information about you could be enough to really sort of put you on a downward spiral, unfortunately. Even if there's nothing compromising or particularly negative in there, just the sheer volume of it could be
You might not have realised how much has been written about you while you've been under a certain service.
Yeah, especially if you have like
collected.
Yeah, especially if you've got paranoid tendencies, then that's really not going to help. There's a couple bits in the chat that I was picking up that I want to just double back on very slightly. Various people sort of echoing what we were saying about basically being a bit more liberal with the use of redactions in the interest of avoiding any harm. And one of the things that Jenny's saying, which I really completely agree with, and actually I meant to mention, I completely forgot, so thank you, Jenny, for raising it, which is in relation to complainants, they treat them as whistleblowers and therefore protect them. And that really has to be taken into account, particularly if you're dealing with ASB or say HR complaints. We help someone with one recently, I think, where someone had made an accusation of racism against an employee, or an allegation that another employee had been racist, you have to protect that type of avenue to bring complaints. And if it's, even if you don't disclose the identity of the individual, etc., simply infringing on the perceived confidentiality of the whistleblowing or complaints process harms it inherently, because instantly people will lose faith in that system. And if people don't feel confident reporting incidents like that, or whether it's antisocial behavior or whatever it might be, then what's the point in having the process in the first place?
Starting to foster a more negative environment where people don't feel safe in their working environment because they don't feel like they can bring up issues.
That's exactly right. I tell you what, we've only got 10 minutes, so let's just blast through a couple more exemptions that I wanted to cover. Somehow I've literally only done like a handful of bullet points this week for our notes, and we've still not needed all of them. It's quite staggering. But there's a couple of bits I wanted to pick up actually, and one of them in particular, it's more of a pet peeve than anything else, than a tip, I suppose. But so you mentioned at the start there are ones like negotiations and management forecasting and potentially the detection and prevention of crime that are all possible exemptions from the right of access and potentially other rights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think what frustrates me sometimes is that it's often forgotten that it has to be the case for those exemptions to apply that the right of access would prejudice the conduct of those activities.
Yeah.
And the word prejudice is obviously key to that. It's not just because, you know, you've got an email on file that was at one point involved in a police investigation that automatically it's exempt because it's to do with crime prevention and detection. There has to be a prejudice to the conduct of that activity from disclosing the information. You have to be able to prove that. And too often, I think it's forgotten about.
I think it has to be either like imminently it's going to prejudice your case, or it's already sort of proven, somebody has said I'm going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And like with negotiations is where I've sort of applied sort of prejudice type things, is like, well, okay, if you know you've got to already have it down that somebody's going to be taking you to tribunal, or say I'm taking you to tribunal soon or something like that, you've got to believe that's a very real possibility. I'm thinking HR cases here, like with disgruntled, disciplined employees that have left. It's got to be a very real prospect. It can't just be, oh, well, they might go to court, but they've not said anything about it, and they seem to be fine with the responses when they left. It's got to be a very real prospect. It can't be just a maybe. There's got to be some like actual solid ground to be able to withhold under negotiations.
That's right. And there's almost again, to draw a parallel to tortious actions that we were talking about before, there's almost like a remoteness test to it, right? You know, how likely is it that it's actually going to cause this?
Yeah.
And you have to have a certain degree of confidence in that. One of the other ones, which I think is, again, sort of weirdly misapplied a lot and a bit of a pet peeve, is confidential references, which is another exemption. But the word confidential seems to be forgotten about a bit when people look to apply this. And it's not there to make up the numbers. If we say confidential reference, then in order to rely on it, you have to be looking at a reference which was made in confidence and which has been treated subsequently confidentially. It's not just because you don't want it disclosed. Or one of the things that Dave often says is that, you know, just because your documents mark confidential doesn't necessarily mean it's confidential. You know, anyone can write the word confidential on a document, but if it's shared around the network and everyone's seen it, well, it's not really confidential, is it? So you have to be able to actually demonstrate that you've gone through that process and that it is genuinely something which shouldn't be disclosed. There's one I put in our notes, and I'm a bit frustrated, to be honest, because I was really hoping you'd have an answer for me, but you've already responded in the notes saying you haven't, which is the self-incrimination exemption. And I've often been curious about this because basically, and if anyone here has ever understood or applied this, please, please, please let me know, because I don't really understand how the self-incrimination exemption is meant to work. Basically, as far as I can tell, it says that you as a controller don't have to disclose information under a SAR if doing so would basically prove that the requester has committed an offence, right? Like, that's kind of the gist of it, and would incriminate them by virtue of them making their request. But I don't really understand how that's meant to work.
I don't understand it, because I don't... Well, no, because surely they know whether they've done something or not, and you having it down in writing isn't going to make a difference. It would depend on, like, a third-party organisation. Surely if the police were asking for stuff, then it's going to take an effect.
Yeah.
But just giving... Like, if I've wrote in an email saying, oh, yeah, I stole this at the weekend to you, and then you send me that back as a SAR, that, like, what does that even mean? It's not going to... I'm not going to self... How can I self-incriminate from that? It'd be you passing that on to the police through an ad hoc request that would incriminate me.
Mm. No, I agree. I really don't understand it.
I'm going to dig into this one a bit more. If anybody has applied it ever, please tell us what happened. What was the circumstances? What were they incriminated about?
Yes, please do get in touch with us, because we don't know and we hate not knowing.
Yeah, we just need an example.
Yeah, literally. That's one of the things that we that I put in here. Oh, there's a question from Stuart. Let me just pick this up, because we are running out of time, but let's just have a look at this. So Stuart asks, any advice on CCTV requests, brackets, we are a pub company, where the incident may be a potential theft / assault. Can we share footage with the apparent victim? So you are the operator of the premises. You operate the CCTV. Someone is caught on camera mugging or assaulting someone, let's say, and the victim puts in a request for the footage. Would you be allowed to share that with them?
So this kind of makes me think when we'd get CCTV requests about damage to cars and car parks, we'd normally say, have your insurance company request the footage and we'll disclose it. So for me, I'd say if the police request it, then you'd disclose it to the police.
I tend to agree that's the belt and braces approach.
I think it would depend on who else is visible in the CCTV.
Yeah, good point. Good point. But then beyond that, So let's say for the sake of argument, right? And Stuart, if you want to come on, obviously please do. But let's say for the sake of argument, you've only got two people in shot, which seems unlikely, but you never know. Say you got two people in shot. One's the victim, one's the perpetrator. So then you're potentially at risk of disclosing the identity of the perpetrator, but that seems pretty reasonable in cases of criminality. So I think
Sorry, here if I can just jump in.
Please.
Yeah, the old advice we always had was you can only share it with the police, but more and more we find the police don't necessarily have the resources to investigate it. So though you think, oh well, we'll wait and our default response would be, well, we'll wait and respond to the police directly. Actually, the police never come calling, because they're a very busy organisation and their priorities aren't always someone who's thinks they've lost a handbag in a pub or whatever it might be. It could be more serious than that. So we have released footage and redacted other people, but it is very complex and time consuming to try and redact people in a busy pub environment. But things like, people might push or shove a member of staff, but because they're inebriated, they think that they were hit first. And so there's often quite complex CCTV footage requests. And the simple answer that we would love is, well, we only share it with the police, but we know that there is the absolute right and that the guidance is quite obscure here and it's not always easy, but it kind of people do have a right to CCTV footage of themselves. And you have to make reasonable requests to answer that and to sorry, you jump in. I was talking too long.
Yeah, there. I think in that circumstance where you just mentioned, there's a pub goer that thinks the staff has pushed them but they're just drunk and have fallen into them. I think in that circumstance I'd invite the person in to view the CCTV footage to show that they weren't shoved, but I wouldn't give them a copy. Mm. But in other cases where actually, one pub goer has assaulted another, I would say it needs to go to the police. I mean, it's just because somebody's like assaulted someone else and they've potentially committed a crime, that doesn't override their sort of privacy.
And inviting someone to view the footage,
I don't think.
The fact, do we still have to redact other faces if they're only viewing it rather than have a copy?
No, I don't think so.
No,
I don't think so. I think
make
I
sure
think,
they don't record a copy on their phone.
Yeah, okay. So yeah. They would view the data, but they wouldn't have a copy of it that they could find. So that the fact that they can inviting them in would remove the redacting issue.
But I think that would be a game case by case. It would that would be fine in circumstances where they think something's happened to them by a member of staff and you're showing them the opposite. But in any case where there's like an obviously criminality thing, I think it needs to go to the police and not to the data subject. I think I would always
criminality is not always a obvious often that's for the police to decide or not.
That's why I would say the police need to request the information to decide if the crime has occurred or not, rather than us disclosing to the data subject as if we're deciding whether the crime has occurred or not.
But it's not that they would only be entitled to their data if there was a crime. If you wait for the police and the police never turn up, someone's still entitled to their footage, right?
Yeah, but you'd redact everything else in that footage.
You would redact everything else.
Yeah, you wouldn't disclose the identity of the assaulter.
Of the perpetrator.
Redact anything to do with the perpetrator.
Yes, and that's what we do. Okay, understood. Thank you for your help.
That's quite all right. Yeah, interesting. Interesting. One of the points that Rick makes is that obviously where the police are involved, then the law enforcement directive applies, which is a whole other kettle of fish, right? In it. So that's something to bear in mind. James made the point that serious harm could be caused if they identify the person wrongdoing. Yeah. Oh, sorry, yeah, if they identify the perpetrator incorrectly. And I hear what you're saying, although it is worth bearing in mind that the serious harm test only applies to education, health and social work data, Carrie?
You need a GP or a social worker to get in on that one. So I don't think you could apply serious harm. I think the best you could do is apply third party information.
But it is worth bearing in mind in the broader context, right? Yeah, I think that's probably fair. I mean, to be fair, also, the problem is we're at the risk of going down a rabbit hole here again. I'll tell you what, I'm not going to finish that thought because we will end up in a rabbit hole.
We'll be like SARS part 4 to finish the rabbit holes.
Yeah, I was about to open a proverbial can of worms, but let's leave that. So we've already overrun by a couple of minutes because of that. There weren't too many other bits. I mean, I did want to talk about ideally legal professional privilege. Just quickly on that, the fact that there's effectively two branches of it, right, which is litigation privilege. So items exempt because they are being prepared for court as part of the bundle. Or the other arm, which is effectively client confidentiality, right? So if it's forms, communications with your solicitor, not necessarily just communications, actually, that's the point. If it forms legal advice provided or received by your solicitor, then it's exempt.
Again, not a blanket approach. You can't use this for everything because this person works in the legal department and they provide legal advice generally. It's very much case by case basis on the pieces of information.
And I believe there's a prejudice point. Oh, is there a prejudice point? There might be. It might be off the top of my head.
I cannot remember. I've only used this one a couple of times.
But either way, certainly case by case, and let's not go blanket approach. I tell you what, to close us out, Carrie, if you wouldn't mind, have you got I'll give you a minute to think about it if you need, because I've got a couple. But have you got any top tips for applying exemptions? And if you need a minute, I can give you mine.
You go first.
Well, I think that the two main points I really wanted to drive home off the back of this was when you are dealing with these complex situations, it is always worth, and I know it's not easy because there are time constraints and resource constraints, etc., but it is often worth just opening up the back of the Data Protection Act and having a bit of a peruse and going, well, hang on a second, I've not really thought about that, and just having a bit of a rummage, because you never know. Sometimes you can't forget about these things. And I think the other point being that if you find something which you think is going to apply, make sure to really work. I know it sounds potentially almost condescending what I'm about to say, but make sure you actually really work thoroughly through how the exemption works. Because one of the things that we know is that the Data Protection Act is worded very specifically and sometimes quite unhelpfully. And the language can be a little bit dense and hard to grapple with. So if you, particularly if it's something potentially sensitive or contentious or something which you know is going to come back, make sure you've really worked thoroughly through the different arms and limbs of these exemptions so that you're super confident in applying it, because otherwise it's just going to potentially expose you, I think. But those would be my number one and number two bits to bear in mind. Is there anything that you've got, or do you want to just echo those?
I think for me, it's sort of just remembering that it is real people. Like, you can get through 1,000 pages of SAR and it can sometimes feel like so far away from your own life that you're reading a storybook, but actually it is a real person. You've got to sort of consider the information you're disclosing, especially with it might not come up with many of our clients, but with like foster care SARs very early on, like in the early years of their lives where they may not remember why they were in foster care, that it is like adding to people's life story and sort of considering what they're going to learn about themselves as well, and putting that support in place to help people where, you know, it may be a bit distressing to read things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's just the point about it being real people is just genuinely a good point for broader data protection matters, right? At the end of the day,
yeah,
we can talk in terms of data and information and data sets, etc., but at the end of the day, these are real people and real lives, and they, you know, need to be protected in that capacity. So anyway, on that slightly glum note, or at least whimsical, let's draw this one to a close, unless there's anything anyone wants to raise, although I'm gonna have to dive off shortly, but if there's nothing else, thank you very much, Carrie, for joining me over this three-part series. I'm glad you have, and I'm sure that everyone here will join me in inviting you back for future ones. That's the nature of these things. You make a rod off your own back and you end up coming every week. So thank you very much for attending. Thank you, everyone, on the session, especially those contributing comments and coming onto the call. We really do appreciate your time and your input and your thoughts. It's a fantastic forum, is this one, that we very much enjoy hosting. And we do hope that that's been at least slightly helpful and informative, and we hope to see you on the next session. We will be back next week with an episode of GDPR Radio. I'll actually be away, but I'm sure Dave, Phil, and possibly yourself, Carrie, can run that without me. Mm-hmm. And then we've got plenty of fantastic events coming up, as we showed at the start. You can reach out to us on all the socials for more information in relation to that and to get involved. But in the meantime, I hope you have a lovely weekend. I hope you all stay safe with these storms about. So do look after yourselves, and we hope to see you all very soon. Mm-hmm.